planning was good for 3 years, and the board at that time opted not to, to make them go through the whole course again. Thinking that there's been changes, there's new data, there's changes in the law, that there's probably enough, even if it is a refresher, to, it's not that much to ask to go through a full a day. It's not even, most of the training course is not even a full day, like four or five hours. It's not that much to ask somebody to go through that, that level of training every 3 years if they're going to be serving alcohol. So to require it to happen every 2 years and put it on sort of a two-year cycle would just be, you know, that much more reinforcement of it to the people that are out there. And again, giving us more of an opportunity to keep the servers in the training program abreast of the changes in the law and the statistics, particularly of some of these things that are being recommended here going into effect, so they become knowledgeable. I mean, we do see those people as sort of the first line. They could be the first line of defense in terms of trying to reduce DUIs or DWIs. So I think investing more money in basically they pay for it or their employer pays for the training. I can't speak for the board, but personally, I don't think the board would have a problem with it, but we haven't told them, but I certainly have no problem supporting that recommendation.
How does our training requirements compare to other states?
Alaska is actually pretty far ahead in this. There are a lot of states that have required no training. I think that's changing, but Alaska was actually probably one of the first, I'd say, 10 states that required it. And there may be, maybe less than half at this point really require alcohol service. I have information about that. I can go back and look at and give you a specific response to that. But I don't know in terms of, you know, what kind of courses. A lot of the courses they are offered by organizations that are obviously involved with it, state or nationwide, represented by the hospitality industry, some form of it. I think Alaska's pretty much, we're not on the cutting edge, but we're out there on the edge somewhere. We're on the knife anyway.
How would you rate the strength of ABC investigation and enforcement statewide?
It's pretty minimal
throughout the state.
It's pretty minimal right now for Representative Berkowitz just because of the fewer officers that we have and the travel funds that we do or don't have to be able to get outside the road system. So we could certainly use additional staff there in terms of investigators. And probably some additional authority as well to carry out the responsibilities that are in Title IV. I mean, if ABC investigators, the way I read Title IV, is they are law enforcement officials, and they're really not given the amount of authority to be able to function in that capacity.
Representative Green?
Thank you. You're talking about the server training. What sort of training would you have if you were busy, which most of them are? We witnessed, I know Representative Murkowski was there, just a couple of weeks ago, we witnessed where APD actually provided a test for anybody who wanted to take it to see how they were reacting when they got up toward point one. And a lot of the people shot right past point one to 1.5, and it would be pretty difficult to tell that they were inebriated. Now, two, I don't know. We didn't have anybody go that high, but there were some there that you could tell, but the majority of them, you really couldn't tell. What is it that this additional training is going to help? What do you do to pick up somebody who's, watch out, unless he's really sloppy?
Well, a lot of it is, again, situations it's hard to. If it's really busy, if you're a bartender or whatever, and it's really busy. But, you know, depending on the circumstances, you know, a good bartender kind of keeps track of
Fred, there's at five or something.
Yeah, the number of drinks being served, how quickly they're being consumed, and then the sort of the skill of maybe saying maybe you need to slow down, or how about a non-alcoholic beverage this round or something like that. I mean, there's things like that you can do to just a lot of it's tact and skill in how to do it, so that you know about how you know, that's a good bartender versus, you know, one that's maybe not as skilled, and it's part of it's human relations and talking to somebody, but trying to keep track and trying to start recognizing that maybe they're in that, they go by a green, yellow, and red zone, that they're in that yellow zone, and that maybe this is somebody we need to start keeping an eye out, and, or when you serve them a beverage, an alcoholic beverage, saying, hey, that's the last time I'm going to be able to serve you for another hour or something, because I think you're, you know, you're consuming too fast. There's things like that you can do, and obviously it's that balancing act that, that an alcohol server has to do, because there's alcohol economic benefits in pushing your product on the person, but also that trying to take that social responsibility of also not wanting this person to become a problem, either in the establishment or later on when they get on the road.
Well, and you also could run the risk of servers, alienating or offending customers. Yeah. You know, somebody that's had a drink and, how many investigators do you have statewide?
Four.
Okay.
Three and a supervisor. We have one in Juneau.
Okay.
Which is a position that we just transferred to Anchorage down there, so we're thinner here, but we really had no coverage in Southeast the last 10 years. We started seeing problems in that region, and we actually thought it was cheaper versus having to send somebody down there from Anchorage to deal with it, to have somebody stationed out of Juneau that could ride the ferry be able to get to some of the communities in Southeast at a lot less expense.
You're aware, though, that a lot of the problems of Juneau are not alcohol-related.
Oh. Yeah. At least 4 months of the year.
Yeah.
The optimum thing in Juneau is that we were able to locate our investigator. We have just a single person in the Department of Revenue office there in the state office building, and they provide clerical support and all those other support methods. We were able to get, I think, a bigger bang for the buck to be able to provide that service and be supported by the organization, the Department of Revenue. We have a supervisor and one investigator here in Anchorage, and we have, again, a single investigator, no clerical support or anything, in Fairbanks. We play mind games about how much we think would be great to have. It's probably 8 investigators would be a good start. I think that we could do a lot more, and then adequate travel money. We sent one of our investigators to Alaska this year, just like once Representative Moses finally got to us, I guess. But it's like a big deal to try to husband all your resources to be able to afford to send a guy out there once every 3 years or something to check on a problem out there. But we've been getting reports. And so that's the kind of problem you have when you don't have, when your travel funds are there to be able to have the board have meetings around the state and also have the. And you do generate our own money from the license fees and so forth. So, I mean, it's all programmer fees that we spend. It's general fund, but general fund programmers.
And you have 4 investigators for how many liquor licenses in the state of Alaska?
We have about, it fluctuates, but we have about 1,830 licenses. And again, to be fair, a lot of those are things that we probably don't spend a whole lot of time monitoring. I mean, we license tour ships and airplanes. Oh. And things probably, so I focus in on the 4 kind of groups of licenses that really, I don't say cause all the problems, but they just need more oversight. That's beverage dispensary licenses, package store licenses, club licenses, and in some cases, restaurant eating place licenses. There's all, I mean, we license golf courses and a bunch of other things. Those tend to not be, those are the assignments I get to go monitor the golf course. The 4 big ones are about 1,100 of our licenses are in those 4 groups: the club, beverage dispensary, restaurant, eating place, and package store. I mean, those are the ones that the people are concerned about. They're the ones that really get on the radar screen. I mean, nobody cares if we're going to license another Alaska Airlines airplane. I mean, that shows up in the statistics. So just to make sure the statistics don't just tell you the whole story, about 1,100 really require supervision.
And these are from one end of the state to the other?
From ADAC to Ketchikan to
200 training licenses per investigator. Is that, how does that compare with the nationwide norm?
Well, again, that's, it's always difficult to compare because, again, a lot of places sell alcohol in different forms more readily. I mean, there's places where you can get beer just about on any stand in probably in Missouri or Wisconsin where they make a lot of it. And so, you know, you can't get wine, you can't get spirits. Here we sell all of our alcohol in package stores, and so that availability is difficult. So there's different kind of licenses. But it's probably, I would say we're probably, don't, just looking at the number of licenses in that ratio to investigators, yeah, we're way behind. There's a lot of states that, that probably are more in the neighborhood of 150 licenses per investigator, something like that. I would say that's a median or anything, but that's, there are places like that. And of course, we've got geography issues, but all the other things that make Alaska easy. So don't need to get into that with it.
But aside from, or in addition to monitoring package stores, restaurant eating places, clubs, et cetera, you also have the responsibility of investigating and addressing the problem of after-hours clubs. Is that not correct?
Well, that is there. I mean, it's a responsibility. That's selling alcohol without a license. We tend to not really get involved with those too much, partly because we don't have the law enforcement authority. The violation that's ours is generally one that's very difficult for us to prosecute, because these an after hours place, generally they go out and buy the alcohol they're going to use that they need that night. So whenever, if you ever were to be able to get a DA to prosecute that offense, they couldn't show this great amount of alcohol, you know, card in all the alcohol that we confiscated. It might be a couple of 12 packs and a couple of bottles, and frankly the DA tell us that that's not very impressive to the jury in terms of selling without a license. So that part of your case is not good. Now if there's drugs and illegal gambling and prostitution or some other things going on there, that's probably where your hook's going to be. So using the sale of alcohol without a license as your basis for prosecution generally is not really high on the list, the way these places operate. So technically you're right, Representative Hawthorne, but I think if you're going to bust those places, there's probably other things that are going to generate more interest and probably longer jail sentences. It is our responsibility. We really don't go there. If we get a complaint from somebody, we'll pass it on to the police department and say, hey, we're willing to assist. If you're going to plan a raid or something, we'll be happy to go along and catalog and confiscate the alcohol and do our alcohol part. But we don't play a major role there.
Any other questions? Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I would say one other thing. I know one of the things that the board is looking at is just that there, in some places, in Anchorage, may not be is probably not as bad a situation as a lot of places. That is there's a concern that there's too many liquor licenses in the state, and maybe there was, and even though our population has gone up, or we're aging, tougher alcohol laws, DWI laws, and so at some point the board. The board is trying to do its best to, I don't think, get rid of liquor licenses, but to make sure that they're being operated so that we don't give these waivers for operating requirements and be prudent about issuing new licenses. But at some point in the future, I think one thing that would be useful to look at would be to try to set up some kind of a fund and actually buy back liquor licenses and retire them and get them out of the system. And that's something where I think a lot of interest from the alcohol treatment community, as well as people that are in the alcohol business. Because obviously, if you get rid of some of the licenses, it makes the ones that remain out there more valuable. So you might be able to even get some financial participation from some of the people that are in the hospitality industry. I keep thinking if we ever got to that point, we'd have an interesting organization or committee around doing that. But you basically, it'd be requiring setting up some kind of a corporation, funding it through federal, state, maybe non-profit, and maybe mental health trust funds. There's all kinds of funding sources and to look at it. Again, Anchorage is not the problem. You've got a lot of places that are like, based on our formula of one beverage dispensary or package store license for every 3,000 population. You've got places that are like 600 or 700% over that formula. Now that's no magic number. That's a number somebody picked and thought it was a good ratio. But based on that, you've got Ketchikan, Kodiak, Nome. Places are probably the ones that come to mind right off the top of my head where you're way past that in terms of having like 25, 30 bars in Ketchikan. And that number, that formula only justifies about 4 or 5. Now, I'm not saying you should actually go down to 4 or 5, but 25 is probably too many.
Two-part question. What is the value of one of these licenses?
Well, basically because almost every jurisdiction is over this quota, we don't issue them. So they're treated like real estate out there. I mean, there's a value. So
ballpark.
And it varies from municipality to municipality. Here in Anchorage, a beverage dispensary license probably, and again, you know, whether you pay cash or the person carries the paper and all those situations, I'll give you a range. Probably around 125,000 to 175,000 for a beverage dispensary license. You might be able to go higher than that, but and then a package store licenses are getting down. You can probably pick up a package store license for $25,000, maybe something like that. They're not as valuable as they once were.
Would there be anything to prohibit a community that individuals in a community that failed to go dry from buying up the licenses?
Not that I know of. I mean, big companies that have a lot of licenses, like OpenKeg or something, every once in a while, they'll have more licenses than they need. They won't, and then when it comes time to renew them, they won't renew them. And since we are over that cap, we're one license closer to being where we should be. In Anchorage, for example, based on the 1 for 3,000, we should have about 81. Bar beverage dispensary licenses, not just bars, and 81 package stores. And actually, we're down to about 92 package store licenses in Anchorage. I mean, we were well over 100 not that long ago. So we're slowly creeping down close to the number that this equilibrium or whatever that we're at here in Anchorage. Package stores, it's getting harder and harder for some of the smaller package stores to compete with the chains. The economics is making it more and more difficult to make it go up in the package. You just own one or two stores.
Thank you very much. Okay. Thank you. Mary Marshburn, are you online still?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Mary. I'm going to ask you to identify yourself for the record, but one of the recommendations of the task force was to require proof of insurance in a valid driver's license to register vehicles. Could you speak to the impacts on your department and how you might enforce that?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, for the record, it's Mary Marshburn, Division of Motor Vehicles. Let's see, I think that was 6?
Yes, 6.
Okay, I was just turning to that. I'm going to speak just generally. In terms of requiring a valid driver's license to register a vehicle, I think you're going to have to talk to the Legal Eagles. I think you have a property ownership issue there, and I'm not an attorney. I do know that there are a number of older drivers, disabled drivers, and people who do not drive, who own vehicles and have others who drive for them. My grandfather, when he was alive, was just such an individual. And so that needs to be taken into consideration. Additionally, you have vehicles that are owned by a husband, wife, or more than one individual, and you may have only one of those people who is the driver. If that person were to have an alcohol violation and be subject to non-registration, then I don't know what you're doing in terms of disenfranchising the other vehicle owner. Those are just things that would have to be taken into consideration. In terms of providing proof of insurance, the division now requires anyone registering a vehicle to certify that they do have insurance. And it is a sworn statement, whether you, no matter how you register that vehicle. We do not require presentation of paperwork as proof of insurance, because that is not proof of insurance. Proof to furnish the small card that some insurance companies give you, the best that that proves is that for the period of time that that card was issued for, you may have insurance. You can, as you well know, get insurance, get the card, cancel the insurance the next day, and there is no proof. There is no absolute proof that can be furnished. The only way that you can really get an accurate fix on mandatory insurance is with an electronic system. And that obviously takes a significant amount of money to do so. Those would be real brief comments, Mr. Chairman, on that particular provision.
Mary, let me ask you. Last year, I remember we addressed legislation that talked about insurance notification, or when an insurance company cancels the policy of a senior citizen. We basically clarified the steps that they have to take. And obviously, the intent was to make sure that there were people out there, that some who had relatives entrusted with their estate, that they obviously needed to clear notification if there was something wrong with the insurance policy. What about having a discussion, or the possibility of having a discussion with insurance companies, where when policies are canceled, you are notified, and I'm assuming in this day and age it could be done electronically. Has there been any discussion in your department about that?
Mr. Chairman, again, we're talking about an electronic system whereby, in most cases, a third party acts as, if you will, a broker. They set up contact with all of the companies that sell insurance, vehicle insurance in the state, and they act as a go-between or on behalf of the DMV, collating the information from companies about policies that are in effect, policies that are canceled, sending out notices to drivers whose policies have been canceled, telling them, for instance, you've got X amount of days in which to obtain new insurance. Yes, we have discussed that. That is a wonderful system if you're going to go to a mandatory, to that kind of a mandatory insurance system. A couple of years ago, I want to say probably 4 or 5 is what I'm told, the division did a cost analysis of setting up that kind of a system. My recollection is that you were talking about adding $2 to every vehicle registration in order to support that kind of a system. Quite frankly, if you were to do it any way other than that, the division does not have the people that it would take, the staff that it would take, to do anything about suspending or revoking licenses when there is a cancellation of insurance, not on a mass basis. Insurance companies could notify us, for instance, on a mass basis that insurance was being canceled. We literally would be playing catch-up, as other states who are in this predicament do, in trying to get those people to purchase new insurance and or suspend licenses of people who don't.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Green.
Utah, I think, is the state that a couple of years ago we were notified that implemented a policy like this. I don't know how that's happened, how effective that's been in keeping it going, but I know when we reviewed, we had a legislation working its way through, and we got pretty negative response, both from the insurance companies and the effectiveness once you got that information about keeping it current. So it kind of just melted away.
Mary, in The drunk driving issue that we're addressing and how it relates to your department kind of dovetails with a larger question, and that is uninsured drivers. And you had mentioned a couple of years ago there was a study that said that you could add $2 to every cost of every registration, and that might cover the cost of administering an automatic notification program or some kind of a notification program.
Mm-hmm.
Is it realistic to say that this increase in fees could be sold to Alaskans as certainly a way of cutting down on uninsured drivers operating on the streets of Alaska? Because I know I've had at least two constituents this summer that have raised concerns about what they pay in uninsured motorist coverage. And so, you know, I'm looking at this as far as maybe we can address a larger problem with this.
Mr. Chairman, I think certainly that is an argument that can be made. As Representative Green pointed out, if I heard him correctly, you're always playing catch-up anytime you have a mandatory insurance problem. If I cancel my insurance today, then according to any provisions in the law, there's going to be a lag time before I receive a notice, whether that's from, you know, a company acting, as I described, an electronic notifier of DMV or from DMV itself that I need to get insurance. Once I receive that notification, then I usually have X amount of days in which to comply. And if I don't comply, then either DMV or that company has to be able to come after me with a license suspension. You're looking, I mean, in the best of worlds, you're looking at anywhere, the very best of worlds, 2 weeks to probably closer to 45 days that that person's on the street and uninsured. I think it isn't, yes, an argument that is going, that a good argument that can be made, but you will never have a perfect world. You will always be playing catch up. Of course, once people, you know, candidly, once people learn to play the game, you can string it out for a lot longer than that. The Insurance Research Council, I think I corresponded with you or your office about this. Insurance Research Council studies these issues on a regular basis, and their latest information indicates that short of an electronic verification system, the system that Alaska employs in many other states of certification is as effective or more so than any of the other mandatory insurance programs. And specifically, that is requiring either people to bring in policies or bring in their little insurance cards, for what it's worth.
Any other questions? Mary, I think that's looking through the recommendations, that was the only one I could really identify that would have an impact on your department. Did I miss anything here on this list of recommendations that you see might have an impact on your department or somehow your department would play a role in implementation?
I had notes, let's see, notes on recommendation 8. I'm just flipping through it now. On 8, which talks about a centralized clearinghouse for licenses, we act that way now to a certain extent. Whenever someone comes in for a new license, we query a national database to which all states in the United States deposit traffic information. And you can't obtain a license in Alaska, nor in any other state, as a matter of fact, if you have an outstanding problem on your license in another state. If your license is suspended or revoked in that other state, you must clear up that offense in that state before you can obtain an Alaska license. So we do have a little bit of that. We do not, the database does not tell us what the problem is. That is, that it's revoked for alcohol, or it's revoked for child support, or it's revoked for points. We don't get that information. We do get that there is a problem. We do not have criminal history access. We would love to have it, as a matter of fact, but we are not defined as an agency entitled to that information, even though, for instance, we license school bus drivers who have to have a criminal history background. So that was the only problem I could see with that one.
Mary, I hate to interrupt you. Representative Berkowitz has a question for you.
On the criminal histories, I mean, I know for example, sex offenders are available on the web, but that's not what you're looking at. You'd be looking for driving infractions, driving crimes?
In conjunction with this particular recommendation, we would be looking for driving, but I noted that it also talks about getting a criminal history. This recommendation said a criminal history background, and we don't have the ability to do that now. That would have to be a law change, and I'm not certain if it wouldn't also entail a federal law change, because there are some, and if you've got somebody from public safety there, they probably can tell you better than I, but there are some public safety or some federal definitions for what qualifies as a criminal justice agency that can have access to a criminal history. It's very restricted.
Lieutenant Tanner?
Lieutenant Tanner still here?
Yes.
I'm only aware of all those restrictions, but I agree. Do you know if Absin or any of the other searches you could do, you would permit limited searches for certain classes? And could you restrict which computers had access to those limited searches? And is there any reason that we can think, I mean, a conviction is a matter of public record. Any reason why DMV wouldn't? But I'm sorry for going on.
Go right ahead.
An alternative would be for the courts to, once there's a conviction of, say, DWI, DUI, forward that information to DMV, and DMV can keep its own records, right?
That would be an option.
With all the appropriate safeguards.
So it's not without the realm of possibility. Bob, did you have a comment on that?
Bob Bailey from the DUI Task Force. In addition to the centralized clearinghouse for checking records, one of the purposes of this recommendation from the task force was to cut down on counterfeit and fake licenses where people get fake IDs. The thought was to be much more control over a license being issued from a central location. So if you go into DMV, for instance, you may get a temporary license, but the actual document would be produced at a central location where, utilizing some of the new technology, where it would be less apt to be forged than the current technology is. So we didn't have a specific recommendation on that, but we just recommended they look into the technology that is available now on creating the actual driver's license itself to prevent forgeries for false IDs.
Mr. Chairman, are you looking for comment on that?
Yes, Mary, please feel free.
Just like there are different vehicle registration systems, plate to owner or plate to vehicle, there are also different driver license systems. Alaska has an over-the-counter system versus a centralized system. There are advantages and disadvantages to both. California, for instance, has a centralized system, and it simply means, as the gentleman has said, that when you go to a DMV office, you get a receipt, basically, but you don't get your driver's license until it's mailed to you from a central facility. There are a few more safeguards in that than there are over the counter. We hope to move to a digital license within the next year or two. We had hoped to be there now and got no responses from bids. We're going to try again and hope to be there, and that should improve Alaska's technology on its driver license. But yes, centralized, you know, a centralized driver license issuance certainly is a consideration. There you have I guess one of the other items that you'd have to consider in converting is public response. We are used to getting our driver's license over the counter. We are used to getting our title at the time that we register our vehicle. We are used to registering to vote right then. How much hue and cry you would have from the public would be interesting.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't want to put any more burden on your front counter people than humanly necessary.
Is there any other questions for Mary?
Mary, before I let you go, and thank you very much for your time and your patience waiting online today, is there anything else you have, obviously picking up from our meeting in August on this same subject, that you have that maybe you could share with the committee as far as your ideas on how we might address this problem we have?
I think I probably echo generally the sentiment of everyone, which is that the problem is alcohol, and it's alcohol that needs to be addressed. Vehicles don't kill people by themselves. Vehicles don't kill people most of the time with reasonable, sober people behind the wheel. The problem is alcohol. Other than that, Mr. Chairman, no, you know, we're happy to respond to any of the proposals that you've put, that are put forward. I think there are some very good ones in terms of alcohol education. Sure would be nice to see that in the schools, but we know what that entails, too, in terms of money and commitment from the Department of Education and the schools.
Thank you very much, Mary. At this point in time, I'm going to go to public testimony. We pretty much covered most of the recommendations, or as far as the specific areas. Obviously, we've talked about the court and sentencing and various other aspects of the problem of driving while intoxicated. So at this point in time, I'm going to go to public testimony. I have a list of a number of individuals online, but this list does not indicate whether or not you wish to give public testimony. So I'm simply going to call the names of the people that I have on this list. If you wish to give testimony, please go ahead. You can identify yourself and your affiliation for the record. Please keep your testimony to 3 or 4 minutes. Don't be offended if I have to cut you off, but we do have a number of people on this list. If you do not wish to testify, just simply say you don't wish to testify. We're going to start with Suzanne Mullen. Lee Kerrigan. Monty Brown. Pam Watts.
Yes, this is Pam Watts. I'm the Executive Director of the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. And my primary interest today was just to listen to the discussion and testimony, and I did want to comment that I'm really gratified that such a broad range of participants were available to offer their expertise and their opinions about the recommendations of the task force. And I would like to say that the advisory board supports a number of those recommendations, and that we are available to provide assistance in providing you and other committees and legislators any background information that might be helpful in making some decisions that you will be faced with during the legislative session. And just wanted to thank you for convening the meeting and support your efforts in addressing this problem. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're going to go to the Kenai LIO. Is there anybody in Kenai that wishes to give testimony? The Fairbanks LIO. Is there anybody in Fairbanks that wishes to give testimony? Is Senator Elton's office still online?
Yes, we are.
Any questions or comments?
No, nothing at this time. Thank you for letting us tie into the hearing.
Certainly. Next, we'll come back here to the room, the conference room. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to come up to the table and give public testimony? Well, seeing none, that's going to wrap it up for today. And just to let you know the intent of the committee, we are preparing a report. My staff and myself are going to prepare a report of what we've discussed today, as well as the research that we've been doing for the last 4 or 5 months. We're going to forward that report in possible draft legislation, the things that we have already worked, to the incoming chairman of the Transportation Committee, and sit down and certainly be available to him to answer any questions and work with him on keeping this process rolling. As most of you know, this was a follow-up meeting. We had an initial meeting in August and committed to getting back together after the Mayor's Task Force released their recommendations. And we certainly want to thank everybody here that served on the task force, as well as those of you who have now attended both meetings, and appreciate your time. If you have any other questions or comments or suggestions, please feel free to communicate with my office. Kevin Hand is the gentleman handling this, and if you have anything further, you can forward that to Kevin. But hopefully when session reconvenes on January 8th, this topic will be number one on the list of things to do. So thank you very much for your time. And with that, we're adjourned.